All right, so I'll talk about the physics of hot QCD matter. And in particular, I will focus on three things. Some of this will be phenomenological, talking about experimental results, but also some theoretical on flow fluctuations and the question of thermalizations. And there are three, for different parts of the talk, there are three different review kind of papers that have recently appeared, which you might find interesting to consult. One is a very general review of the field in science with Barbara Jacek, who is an experimentalist, the leader of the Phoenix Collaboration. Another one is with two other experimentalists, Jürgen Schukraft and Boleg Wüßlauch, on the first results from the Large Hadron Collider using lead beams. And finally, review of the question of how entropy gets produced and created in dynamical systems with Andrea Schaefer. So, the whole field became a reality of with two large accelerators. One, the relativistic Hadron Collider in Brookhaven, the other one, very recently, the Large Hadron Collider, which are capable of colliding heavy nuclei at energies of multiple times the rest mass of nucleons. So the top energy of RIC is about 200 GeV per nucleon in each nucleon pair. And the top energy of the LHC at the moment is 2.76 TeV for a nucleon pair in the colliding nuclei. So this is about 13.8 times the energy of RIC. And it will in the future go up by about another factor of two. When you collide nuclei, you have to figure out what actually happens. And for that, you need capable detectors. There are two such detectors at RIC. One is called the Phoenix detector. The other one is the Starry detector. Basically, what they do is they measure all kinds of particles coming out of the collision, particles that are mostly produced. And they try to decipher from that, with the help of theorists, what actually happened during the collision of the heavy ions. And at CERN, we have three detectors. ATLAS and CMS are standard high-energy detectors that were primarily built for proton-proton collisions to look for supersymmetry, Higgs particles, and so forth. And the ALIS detector, which is a detector very similar to the STAR detector at RIC that is specifically built to detect heavy ions. So the first major finding, or the first major conclusion that came out of the physics program at the relativistic Hadron Collider was that it was, to some extent, surprisingly found that when one analyzes the emission pattern of particles, and I will discuss that in a bit more detail later on, they all look like they are emitted from a thermalized fluid that behaves as a nearly perfect liquid with a very low shear viscosity measured in terms of the entropy density of the matter. So this was a conclusion reached in 2005. 5 years later, actually, there were the first measurements that showed that actually the temperature of this matter was beyond the temperature in which one would, from lattice calculations, expect hadronic matter dissolve into quark-gluon plasma. And so there are now a number of big questions that arise from this for theorists to think about. The first one is, what actually is a perfect liquid? There's a lot of progress on that, and we roughly know what this is. What is the structure of a quark-gluon plasma that is being produced, of the gauge plasma that is being produced in heavy ion collisions at the relativistic of heavy ion collider? When you increase the energy by almost a factor of 15, is that still the case? Does QCD matter still behave in the same way as one saw it at lower energies? Is there an energy scale in which the plasma that is being produced is actually strongly coupled? When you go below that scale and weakly coupled above that scale, at least crudely speaking, because we know that QCD is asymptotically free, and so above some scale, you would expect that the coupling has to become weak. how does the matter that we observe in the end actually thermalize? How can you take the energy in the collision of two ground state nuclei and convert it into a nearly perfectly thermalized plasma in a fraction of the time that it takes light to traverse a proton? And how does the structure of the colliding nuclei manifest itself in the plasma afterwards? In other words, how do we understand what fraction of the energy in the colliding nuclei is actually deposited into a thermalized gauge plasma? And there are many more questions, but these are just a few that I wanted to bring up. Now, what we know for certain about real QCD at non-zero temperature and non-zero baryon density is summarized in a sense here. This is a calculation here from the Wuppertal Budapest lattice gauge group of the energy density as a function of temperature in QCD divided by the temperature of the four with realistic quark masses, with physical quark masses, but under the assumption that there is no net baryon density. This is when the calculations are really rigorously doable. And you see that as you increase the temperature, that grows rapidly and eventually approaches saturation point that is a little bit less than what you would expect if you have non-interacting quarks and gluons, thermally excited as massless particles, and that's well understood. This is simply due to the fact that there are remaining interactions, and quarks and gluons at finite temperature interact with each other, so they're quasi-particles, they have a non-zero mass, they have additional interactions that actually reduces the energy density. The temperature at which that transition takes place is, of course, not perfectly well defined because it's a continuous transition. But if you look at the inflection point, then you can determine a critical temperature of the order of about 150 to 160 MeV with an uncertainty of about 10 MeV, depending on which observable you look at in order to determine such an inflection point. A phase diagram has not only the temperature, it also has the direction of net baryon density, which is given by the baryon chemical potential. At zero temperature, of course, you have the nuclei. At much higher density, you would have the cores of neutron stars. Lattice calculations now believe that they can actually, or that the people doing lattice calculations believe that they can actually do reasonably rigorous calculations in a wedge that goes from down here at a curve, and it is bounded by zero baryon chemical potential, and a line that goes up here and hits 150 MeV at about 100 MeV or 200 MeV of baryon chemical potential. So there is a whole wedge in which now, with improved calculations, one believes one can determine the equation of state. There has been a lot of speculation that because here the transition is continuous, that if you go into the plane, the mu baryon temperature plane, that there is somewhere a critical point, and beyond that, a first order phase transition. But what the calculations find is that in the range, in the wedge in which they believe they can do rigorous calculations, there is no critical point. And it is still an open question whether there is such a point or not. Some people believe from the argument of models that there should be one, but some of the best lattice calculations actually indicate that the width of the transition as you go in this direction does not shrink. So it does not look as if you're approaching a critical point. The experiments at RIC and the LHC at the highest energy govern roughly this region. They populate matter at very low baryon chemical potential, but high temperature, and so this here is the region that is actually deduced from comparing the experimental data with hydrodynamic simulation of the evolution of the matter. And if you go down in energy at RIC, which you can do, then of course you create matter with lower and lower temperature and higher baryon density. And so you populate a region like this, which is now being explored. But I won't say anything about that.
Right.
What, on
these best simulations, how much of an effect is that?
It's about a, in this temperature range, it's about a 20% effect. Yeah. But you can push the calculations, of course, up to much higher temperatures, and then you can show how you slowly approach, logarithmically approach the free limit. But, I mean, the coupling constant, even at the Planck scale, is still, I think G is about 1/2. And so it's never that weak that you really are in that limit. So this shows, no, this shows the best measurements of actually what the temperature of that emitting system of particles is. Of course, since the matter that you produce at high temperature and then expands and cools, you don't measure the temperature at any given moment. What you do is you measure the spectrum of emitted photons over a certain range. And so it's weighted with the emission from a whole range of temperatures. And because the fireball expands and becomes larger, it is somewhat more weighted to lower temperatures, right? Imagine that you have a system that is small and radiates hotly, and then it expands and radiates cooler and cooler. So, but because the system becomes larger, you get more emission at a later time. And so, as a matter of fact, when you now look at the spectrum of photons emitted by the system, you expect that the temperature that you measure, the apparent temperature, is less than the initial temperature at which you expect the system. And you need hydrodynamic simulations to do an explicit calculation to infer back what was the original temperature. So here is a measure, the best measurement from Rick, gold-gold collisions. And by looking at the photon spectrum here at the lower transverse momenta in the range of about 1 to 3 GeV, one deduces an apparent temperature of 220 MeV. If one goes back and asks, what does that imply for a temperature at a reasonable initial thermalization time, it's about 350 MeV. At the LHC, the momentum scale is a lot expanded, but when you look here at the spectrum now, you find the temperature that you see apparently is 308 MeV, and if you go back, then it corresponds to roughly something like 450 to 500 MeV at the moment of initial thermalization. So it's about 30, 35% hotter than the system that you produce at RIC. That's not a big step, but it is a significant step. So now I talked about the evolution, the expansion of the fireball. The way when one looks in the QCD community nowadays at how such a collision between nuclei proceeds, it is in first approximation a one-dimensional phenomenon. You collide nuclei along a beam direction, and after the collision, the system expands furiously again in the longitudinal direction because that is the momentum that you bring into the collision. Afterwards, because of the internal pressure, the system also expands in the transverse direction, but that expansion is relatively slow. At the end of the expansion, it's maybe half the speed of light, whereas in the direction, it is really almost at the speed of light in the longitudinal direction. And so you have here the longitudinal axis. Here's the time axis. You have the two beams come in, interacting, depositing energy in some complicated form. In the pre-equilibrium phase, which eventually thermalizes, produces the gauge plasma, the quark-gluon plasma, that expands and cools and eventually goes back into hadrons, which then eventually move to the detectors. And this is what you see at the end, and this is a nice picture from the star detector looking along the beam axis, so you see everything goes out radially. Particles get deflected by the magnetic field, but without the field, they would just radially emerge. And when you look from the side, then you see that particles also go in all directions, forward, backward, to the side, and so forth. The paradigm within the QCD community of how you actually seed this gauge plasma is the following. You have a nucleus moving at high speed, so when you look at it from the center of mass system, it looks Lorentz contracted. And so basically, all the nucleons in that spherical or nearly spherical nucleus are squished into a pancake. When you now ask the question, what is the proton content of that nucleus? Of course, it will be quarks and gluons. But if you look at small momentum fractions, which are likely to be stopped and deposited, then they're predominantly gluons. And so you have a certain gluon density in that nucleus that can be described in terms of an area density or a momentum scale that says, at which inverse momentum do I have one gluon? So the gluon density is given by something like this so-called saturation scale multiplied by the number of nucleons going longitudinally through the nucleus and the rate at which the gluon distribution grows with momentum fraction x, and this equal to 1. So this gives you a relationship how that saturation density at which you have encounter one gluon per unit area grows with the nuclear size, and as you go to smaller and smaller momentum fractions, or at a given momentum, larger and larger beam energies. Once they collide, then these gluons interact, and they deposit gluonic energy in the region between the colliding nuclei, whereas the valence quarks go their own way, left and right, and disappear out of that system. So initially, this will seed a highly excited, dense gluonic state with a smaller number of quarks and antiquarks, which then eventually will be produced simply by the interactions among these gluons. So when I now look at a sequence of events in that concept, you have initially that dense gluonic system in the individual nuclei, which is in its ground state. It's called the Kalaglass condensate because it's a ground state, highly nonlinear, strongly interacting gluon system. You then have a pre-equilibrium system of scattered gluons that sit roughly at rest in the center of mass, which is has been termed the glasma. Once that thermalizes and equilibrates, of course, it forms the quark-gluon plasma, which behaves like a hydrodynamic fluid, then hadronizes and eventually breaks up into hadrons. Now, the particular term perfect fluid or nearly perfect fluid applies to this phase. We know that the viscosity of a hadron gas is relatively large because hadronic cross-sections are not strong enough to actually make the velocity very small. And we know, as a matter of fact, not very much in detail, except in certain models, about this early equilibrium phase. Since it's not in equilibrium, it's not completely clear what you mean by transport coefficients. But whether this is something that behaves also in a certain liquid way or not is, at the moment, reasonably unknown. No. So this has actually been investigated to great extent. So the way that the hadronic gas phase is now treated is using typical microscopic Boltzmann transport. So you actually treat all the individual hadronic species, two to two interactions, and so forth. As you approach this critical temperature of 150 MeV, the density becomes so high that that description becomes unreliable. But it is, so there should be somewhere a transition where this microscopic description morphs into a hydrodynamic description and a boundary at which both are not perfectly reliable. But over most of that phase, it's more like a dilute system. So you use standard kinetic theory. Yeah. Which, of course, involves a lot of unknown quantities because one knows a lot about hadronic reactions, but not about reactions between all possible species of hadrons. So now I want to talk briefly about the fluid part. The way one draws conclusions from the experiment is by looking at collisions between two nuclei that are not completely central. And that is in which part of the nuclei pass each other and the overlap collision region is anisotropic just from a geometric effect. If one has then a system that is equilibrated and that has such an almond shape, the pressure gradients horizontally are larger than vertically, so it expands faster in the transverse direction. And so one obtains an anisotropic momentum profile of particles afterwards because of that anisotropic flow profile. Experimentally, one analyzes this by defining a collision plane, that is a plane in cutting through the centers of the two colliding nuclei. This would be the event plane angle psi n, and then measuring the distribution of particles azimuthally around that axis. In this case, that plane would just be the horizontal. And one makes a Fourier decomposition in terms of the cosine functions, and then one has coefficients of each of the multiples. So V0, V2, V1, V2, V3. V0 one usually puts to zero because that's simply put into that normalization coefficient. But there could be a V1, a dipole, there could be a quadrupole, an octopole, and so forth. And indeed, one has measured many of those now. In this idealized situation, there is predominantly a quadrupole term because it is symmetric left and right, up and down, and so the first term that should be non-zero is a V2 with a cosine 2 phi. There could also be a V4, a V6, and so forth, but all the odd multiples should be zero. And that is indeed what one finds if one averages over many collisions. One then goes and actually takes these initial conditions and solves hydrodynamics, passes it through a hadronic final state kinetic theory, and then compares with the data. In the hydrodynamics, really the unknown parameters are the energy density pressure relation, that is the equation of state. Now, that's something we can calculate on the lattice. So it has become customary to simply take the lattice equation of state, the energy density as a function of temperature, pressure as a function of temperature, and so forth, and say, we know that. We don't have to worry about that. Now, this is, of course, only true if the system is perfectly thermal, but it turns out that small deviation from that have negligible effect on the expansion. What does have a tremendous effect on the expansion is the shear viscosity in the dissipative term. And the reason for that is that the system is has a very high flow gradient in the longitudinal direction. Right? The system expands rapidly in the longitudinal direction, so you have tremendous flow gradients in the longitudinal direction, which produce big effects from that viscous term. There could also be a bulk viscosity, and modern calculations actually take that into account. The only problem is we don't really know very well what the bulk viscosity is. In the limit of a conformal invariant system, it should be zero. QCD is not conformally invariant, especially close to the critical temperature, so it could be substantial. And so that's something that will need to be investigated. The general conclusion so far has been that the bulk viscosity terms, even if the bulk viscosity is the largest one could imagine on the basis of models of QCD, is probably not an important effect compared to the shear viscosity. And that has to do with the effect that actually that longitudinal expansion really doesn't significantly contribute to that term. So to remind you, the shear viscosity is simply the ability of a fluid to equilibrate flow in different directions at different places. In the kinetic theory, the shear viscosity is given by 1/3 times the particle density times the average momentum times the mean free path. The smaller the mean free path, the more difficult it is to exchange momentum at different places. So small mean free path means small shear viscosity. A small mean free path means a large cross-section among particles in kinetic theory, which means strong interaction. So small shear viscosity means strong interaction. And one can write down various ways in which one then expresses the shear viscosity. For a system of massless particles, one finds that the shear viscosity divided by the entropy density of the system, because the entropy density is connected with the particle density as well, should be larger than some bound, which is a number times h bar over the Boltzmann constant. One can make a guesstimate of what that number is in kinetic theory, but obviously, in the limit in which one approaches that bound, the system is strongly coupled and kinetic theory fails. So in other words, whatever one gets out of this is not reliable. One needs a dynamical theory of a strongly coupled system to do that. And this is, of course, where the string theory came in. The holographic dual approaches to strongly coupled gauge theories that allow to actually solve the dynamics of those explicitly and exactly in terms of the dynamics of a gravity theory in an anti-de Sitter space. And the conclusion of that was, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this, is that there is at least in certain types of this theory, a limit on this ratio, which is 1 over 4 pi times h bar over the Boltzmann constant. Of course, it's been found that there are certain higher derivative models in which that bound can be violated, but any of the violations, as far as I know, are not very large. They're of maybe 3/4 or 9/16 or so of that number, but not a very much smaller number of that limit. So this is what comes out of such arguments. Now, what I mentioned before, what I showed you before, the overlap region of the collision between two nuclei as being a nice, smooth, almond-type object is actually not true. The reason is that nuclei contain only a finite number of nucleons. Even a gold nucleus has 197 nucleons. A lead nucleus has 208. And so when you actually ask the question, what is the density profile of the overlap when two nuclei collide, you find that it is anything but smooth. This is a typical simulation of what the near-central overlap between two gold nuclei looks like. You have regions in which the energy density is very significantly higher than other regions, and the ratio of the peak to the valley here is easily of the order of 4 or 5. So these are not small fluctuations. There are big fluctuations. In this simulation, what has been assumed is that the profile of energy density in the nucleus is governed by the nucleon distribution. So the typical scale is 1 femtometer. Now that may not be right, and I will give you an argument in a moment why that may not be right, but that's the assumption here. That gives you this type of energy density fluctuations. Now, if you seed a hydrodynamics calculation with energy inhomogeneities of that type, they survive. If the fluid is highly viscous, they get damped out very quickly. But this fluid is very inviscid, almost as inviscid as possible. And so these fluctuations survive quite long, which means that the system that expands does not only have even multipoles of flow that it generates, but also odd multipoles, because this can have a dipole moment, this can have an octopole moment, this can have all kinds of higher moments in the energy density distribution. And these can be measured experimentally. The way you do that is that you actually do the analysis in each individual event, especially at the LHC, where about 10,000 particles come out of the collision. You can analyze the multiple structure of the particle emission in the azimuthal direction in each individual event. I mean, you cannot go to multipole 1,000, but you can go to multipole 6 or 7. And so this is what the ATLAS detector has done, and other detectors in the meantime have done something similar. They have determined the value of the coefficients of the flow V2, V3, V4, V5, V6 in a lead-lead collision for different geometric overlaps of the nuclei. This would be the most central, the most overlap, down here to collisions in which only half the nuclei overlap. And they've measured this flow profile as a function of the longitudinal momentum of the emission of the particle. And what they find is that these are basically independent of the longitudinal momentum, which means that the structure that I showed you before of the inhomogeneities are all independent in rapidity. That is, they're probably seeded at very early times in the collision, and they're not produced at a later time. So the error bars here show you that these measurements can actually be done now with reasonably good precision. So now what you can do is you can not only use this coefficient V2 to analyze the shear viscosity, but you can do it also with the higher coefficients. And that should give you additional checks on what the shear viscosity that you need in the hydrodynamics calculations are. So here are calculations of this type done by people from Brookhaven and McGill. And they use data from RIC to actually analyze, in this case, just V2. And they find that the curve where shear viscosity over entropy density is 1 over 4 pi gives by far the best fit to the data. So this would be the Sonne-Starinitz limit. When they analyze also V3 and V4, they find that the agreement is not as perfect, but it is actually pretty good. So in other words, it seems that this is this shear viscosity value that you get is actually pretty consistent between these different flow multiples. You see that the V3 experimentally is somewhat higher than the calculation. The V4, again, is pretty well described. And so it seems that actually there's something missing in the calculation. We'll see that later on in another type of plot. Mm-hmm.
So in this case, is the assumption that the bulk viscosity is zero and it's a equation?
Yes. That's the assumption here. Actually, the equation of state is not conformal. The equation of state is the one that comes out of the lattice. Okay, so that is, the equation of state is not varied, it's that out of the lattice, but the bulk viscosity is taken to be zero. There have been, not these people, but other people have done simulations including a bulk viscosity, and they found that it has very little influence, unless they crank it up to unreasonable values. But that's something that's still somewhat open, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Was that LHC data?
These were LHC data.
So is the, you pointed to error bars, is RIC producing similar results?
First of all, RIC cannot, with the detectors at RIC, they're not able to produce results over such wide rapidity range. Okay? Because this is from Atlas. Atlas is a $1 billion detector, which has a tremendous rapidity coverage. CMS can do similar measurements. There is no detector RIC which at the moment is capable of doing that measurement because they don't cover enough. If you ask, can they in single events go down with similar error bars to V5 and V6? The answer is probably not, because the number of particles emitted in a collision is 1/3 of that at the LHC. So that means that you have 1/3 of the statistics in the particle correlation. Actually, what you do is use two particle correlations to get that, to get the angle in a given event. And so you suffer about a factor of 9 in statistics.
But the direction I was going is when we go back, when we go forward now, mm-hmm. and they do this analysis, now they're apparently using RIC result. And so do I worry so much that it doesn't quite fit?
I think here you should worry about the V3. The before, you see, the deviation is not bigger than the errors. So the before probably shouldn't. The fact that there's no V5 and V6 simply means that it's very difficult to do with good statistics at RIC. Yes, I'll come to that right now. So a systematic study now involves not only varying the shear viscosity, but also varying the initial conditions. And so we'll stay with RIC for a moment, but we'll come to the back to the LHC just in a, also in a moment. But for now, let's stick with RIC. This is now an analysis in which not only the shear viscosity has been varied, but also the initial conditions. And there are two types of initial conditions that have been explored, one called Monte Carlo Glauber, which basically treats simply energy deposition in nucleon-nucleon collisions as if that's the only degrees of freedom that matter. And so the profile initially is simply given by nucleons. And this uses a so-called Monte Carlo KLN, which also is based on the scale of the size of inhomogeneities of nucleons, but it assumes that the profile of the energy density that you posited is not governed by the nucleon density, but by the gluon density, which is a little bit different because the gluon density has this nonlinear saturation effect. And so it has a different profile in transverse direction than the nucleon profile. It's not a big effect, but it is a substantial effect in the transverse shape. And what you find is that if then you want to make a comparison for this profile that just takes into account the nucleon distribution in a gold nucleus, you get a pretty good fit with 0.08, maybe 0.1. That's slightly larger than 1 over 4 pi. Whereas if you use this other profile, you need roughly 0.2. So it changes by a factor of 2 the shear viscosity that you need to fit the data if you change the profile. Now, what these people have found, and I don't have the plot for that, but it is published, is that if they now go and actually ask, how well does this value, which is used to fit the V2, the quadrupole anisotropy, how well does it fit the V3? This one works reasonably well. This one fails drastically. So in other words, on the basis of higher multiples, it seems that this is pretty much excluded. This fit is not very good, as you saw in the previous plot, but it is sort of okay. So in order to actually figure out not only what the shear viscosity is, but also what the initial distribution is, the profile of the energy density, you need not just one multiple, you need several multiples. And the results are connected in a sense that a different initial energy density profile will give you a different value of the optimal shear viscosity. Not by large factors, but by a factor of 2. So now let me make a brief theory digression. If we make the argument that actually the energy deposited in this collision comes out of the gluon content of the nuclei, not where the quarks sit, because they never get deposited. They continue. They get a little tickled in the collision, but they continue down the beam pipe. What really gets stopped is these relatively low momentum gluons residing as field in the nucleus. Then we should do a calculation of the initial distribution of energy deposition based on such an approach. And so what you need to do is you need to actually start out from the distribution of gluonic field in a nucleus based on that concept that due to the nonlinear direction among gluons, the gluon density at some point saturates, and that you can approximately, that is this concept of the color glass condensate model, you can approximately describe the distribution of gluons by a Gaussian ansatz. So in other words, what you do is you treat the gluons as a field generated by a distribution of color charges, which are the valence quarks and maybe some of the hard gluons. And the distribution of that charge that generates the field is given by a Gaussian distribution function that has one parameter, namely the average density of the gluon field or the color charge density, this g squared times mu squared, where mu is the area density of color charges generating the field. Or mu squared is the area density of color charges. And g is, of course, the QCD coupling constant. Once you make that ansatz, you can now start calculating what the energy density in detail, the profile in the nucleus is, and you can calculate how you deposit energy density and what the fluctuations of that energy density are. So the quantity that you want to calculate is the fluctuation of the energy density as a function of the position in the transverse direction to get that grainy profile that I showed you before, but now based on not nucleons, but based on the gluonic content of a nucleus. And then the energy density is the energy of deposited gluons, which comes from the fusion or the collision between gluons from each nucleus, nucleus one and nucleus two. They interact through a three gluon vertex and they deposit energy. And so you can write down the equations that describe that process. What you need is the correlation function of the gauge field in the nucleus before it collides, or in the nuclei before they collide. You have to do that in a specific gauge to do the calculation. One usually uses the light cone gauge. And so X and Y are the transverse positions in the colliding nuclei. Then one can make a Fourier transform and express that in terms of a momentum correlation function of the gluon field in the nucleus, or one can write it in terms of the position distribution. There is a general form that comes out of this gluon condensation, a gluon saturation model that I've written down here, but this is probably an approximation making certain classical large NC limits. In reality, it may be slightly different. I'll show you what happens if you vary that function a little bit. The main quantity that goes into this is this density of color charges, or when you multiply it with the coupling constant, this so-called gluon saturation momentum. So then you can plot what the probability of what is the fluctuation of the energy density divided by the energy density average. Or in other words, what is the relative fluctuation of the energy density as a function of transverse separation of two points? So you get a correlation function of the deposited energy density. And the important thing that I want you to take away from this is number two, are the following two. First of all, at the same point, the fluctuation of the energy density deposit is large. It's about 70%. That's just the variance, which means you have a non-vanishing probability of actually depositing three or four times the energy density than at other places. And the other one is that its typical width is about, well, if you go halfway down, say here, is about 0.25 femtometers. It's about a quarter of the size of the nucleon. So in other words, the size of these transverse fluctuations should be much smaller than those that I showed you in the previous simulation, where they were based on the nucleon size, their subnucleon size. Three different assumptions about that correlation function of the gluon field in the individual nuclei turn out to give you very little difference. So it's not very sensitive on the details of the distribution of gluons in the nucleus, but it really shows you that there is a tremendous capacity of fluctuating energy density. Here is an implementation of that formalism. And when you look here now, this is a cut, transverse cut through the collision region. So this is x and y direction. And you see that this has very narrow spikes. I mean, the total diameter is maybe 12, 13 femtometers. That's big nuclei, gold or lead, in this case, lead nuclei. And the spikes individually have about a quarter of a femtometer. So this is a very spiky, rough initial energy density distribution. Of course, this is at a very early time. The system is not thermalized at all. We don't really have a good calculation of how it thermalizes, but one can make certain assumptions and so forth, and then, and of course, simply free streaming will smooth out that distribution and make it more homogeneous over time until you start the hydrodynamic calculations. These were the distributions, Glauber and KLN, that I showed you before that gave a factor of two different results. So what will this give? The same people, at least one of the same people, have now done hydrodynamic simulations for the LHC, for lead on lead and the LHC, to fit their multipole data. And they get an excellent fit, not only for V2, but for V3, V4, V5. So this is a much better fit than what I showed you before for Rick using this distribution. In other words, the fact that the distribution initially is much more inhomogeneous seems to solve the problem with the V3. That's not surprising. Why? Because the V3, the octopole component, is solely coming from the fluctuations. If the theory underestimates it, it means it does not have enough initial fluctuations. This has enough. So it seems that we now have a way of seeding the initial hydrostate that not only gives you the right fit for one of the curves, but for all of the curves. And it suggests that you actually indeed have these much finer and stronger fluctuations at the very early moment after the collision. The shear viscosity of entropy ratio they find is 0.2. Now, this has not been fully explored in all directions. It means it is not impossible that you could get a solution with 0.1 and a slightly different initial inhomogeneity distribution. That is possible. But nobody has explored that. These things are calculations that have come out only in the last few weeks. Actually, they were presented for the first time 3 weeks ago at a conference. But it now looks as actually one understands how to do this. And I would expect that over the next year or so, this will be explored to the point where one really knows what the data constraint. And I would not be surprised if there would be a somewhat different value coming out for the LHC than for Rick, because after all, it is a different system. It has different energy density. So why should all the physics quantities be exactly the same? Last topic about this. And this is now related. You saw that the value of these curves started high for V2, then V3, and so on. They went down the higher multiples, which means that the power spectrum of multipole excitations in the flow profile is actually falling rapidly with the multipole. And so here is a calculation that, again, another person, but using similar approaches, but not this initial condition, did to calculate the power spectrum of these initial fluctuations and their final flow profiles as a function of the multipole. So this is now 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. Before you saw curves for 2, 3, 4, and 5, but now he's actually calculated up to 7. And it uses data from, I think, the CMS experiment at CERN to compare with these calculations. And you see that for, he used the Glauber profile, so for zero shear viscosity, he gets the black points. For 1/4 pi, he gets the blue points, and he gets green for 0.2. And when you compare the data and the experiment, well, then you see that you get maybe a reasonably good value for 0.2, but the n equal 2 doesn't agree very well. So again, here, I think this needs further study. This is probably not the right initial condition. And so the relative size of the V2 and the V3 will not be correctly described. So this is the state of the art. I would say in a year, probably, we will have sufficiently broad exploration of this to know what the data really prefer. But it's making rapid progress. Certainly, 6 looks, the value that you get is still considerably larger than the error bar. For 7, the error bar and the value are almost the same. So I think 7 is probably the end of it, would be my guess. But, I mean, one has to be careful. These are the first runs. There will be a lot more data coming later on. And if the LHC goes to twice the energy, it may very well be possible that one gets to 7 and 8. I think it's a question of how many different parameters you think are relevant for the initial condition. If it is, like in the theoretical consideration I showed you, if it is basically a correlation function of gluon density in the colliding nuclei, then I think the answer is clearly yes. If you introduce more parameters, maybe not. But and this hasn't even explored all the possibilities, because all these things come out of two-particle correlations. One particle is basically used to fix the reaction plane, and the second particle then measures the distribution around it. But you could easily, and experiments have just now started to do that, go to three-particle correlations. If you have 10,000 particles coming out, or even in one rapidity interval 1,000, why not do three-particle, four-particle correlations? So I think this will eventually allow a lot more detailed investigation. In particular, we have a paper that written about a year ago, where we showed that if you can do three-particle correlations, you are actually sensitive to the number of dense and dilute regions in the transverse plane. So this would then allow us to somehow determine the scale of the fluctuations in the transverse size. So I think if you go, there's a lot more room for experimental observables also, which hasn't been explored. Okay. So I covered a lot less than I thought I would, but I think that's fine. Let me maybe just cover this and then finish. So the other remarkable effect that we see in these nuclear collisions is that they suppress the emission of high-momentum particles. This is called jet quenching, and the idea behind this is very simple. If you have a hard scattering, say, between two quarks in the center of such a colliding nuclear system, then in order to make it out of that dense matter, they have to propagate through it, and in that way they scatter, they lose energy, either by depositing energy in the binary scattering or by radiation of a gluon. So particles emerging from that system, if they have high momentum in the transverse direction, have less energy, and therefore in a steeply falling spectrum, it looks like you have fewer particles of the same momentum emitted. So this is the jet quenching effect. The two primary losses of energy that people have been considering are called elastic energy loss. That's basically a collision with some constituent in the medium, which you then kick and which takes up some of the energy, or that you basically have a quark that collides multiply, radiates a gluon, which also collides multiply in the medium. So this is like a wiggler effect of a charged particle, which then radiates. And so this enhances the radiation of gluons, and therefore enhances the energy loss of such a quark coming out. The magnitude of this effect is parameterized by a quantity called Q hat, which is the mean momentum transfer squared per distance traveled. So this is like GV squared per femtometer. And you can actually express this quantity as an integral over a correlation function of glue field strength at two different points along the light cone, that is along the path of this rapidly moving quark, integrated along the light cone. So it's basically something like the square of the gluon field in the transverse direction multiplied by the correlation length in the longitudinal direction. This coefficient here, E hat, is the usual dE dx coefficient that you would find if you shoot charged particles through matter and you ask how much energy does it lose per unit distance. It also turns out to be given by a correlation function of glue fields, but of a slightly different form. Now, it turns out that there's an interesting connection between this coefficient Q hat, the transverse momentum fluctuations of a particle that propagates through the medium, and the coefficient of, and the shear viscosity eta, or eta over S. And this comes about because you have another way of writing this correlation function here, this expression. It is given by the differential cross-section of a particle going through the medium, at least in kinetic theory it is, multiplied by the momentum transfer squared, and then integrated over transverse momentum and multiplied by the density. So in other words, this is sensitive to the differential cross-section in the forward scattering direction, but not very forward because it is weighted with Q squared. On the other hand, in a gauge theory, certainly in a not too strongly coupled gauge theory, cross-sections are dominated by small angle scattering. And so you can then work this out, and you find that you can actually relate this Q hat coefficient to the shear viscosity over entropy density ratio by the ratio of the temperature cubed over this Q hat multiplied by a factor here that is of order one. It's not exactly a constant, because it turns out that when you do the calculation, this depends in a logarithmic manner on the energy of the projectile. So it's a logarithmically varying quantity, but it is of order one, which means that if the shear viscosity of entropy density ratio is small, Q hat has to be large. Now, it is interesting because in a strongly coupled plasma, eta over S is bounded from below by unitarity effects. On the other hand, Q hat can become as large as it wants if the coupling is sufficiently strong. Actually, in the dual picture, what you find is that at large values of the coupling, the Toff coupling, this expression here goes like 1 over square root of lambda. This here is 1 over lambda, so if lambda becomes large, you go to the left, and so it falls like 1 over square root of lambda, whereas eta over S saturates as 1 over 4 pi. So in other words, if you could measure these two quantities independently, you could deduce from that whether you're in a weakly or a strongly coupled region, because the ratio between them changes drastically. So there is some interest in actually determining the value of this Q hat. And so here, how does one do that? One looks for the energy loss that you see in jet production. And so here, for example, is an event seen by the CMS detector where you have a die jet. You have a collision of two quarks, one goes this way, the other one backwards, normally you would expect that both jets have roughly the same transverse energy, because there's no transverse energy coming in, so it has to be balanced in the binary collision. What they see is that one jet has 200 GeV, the other one has 70. So in other words, this jet has lost more than half the energy of its original primary particle in the interaction with the medium. This is again where the LHC has an advantage, because you can measure jets of much higher energy than at rest. So how do you describe this now? One way to do that is, and this is now making use of basically the perturbative QCD theory of jet quenching, is to say, well, you have the effect that a primary quark radiates gluons. These are now the blue lines. But these gluons interact with the medium itself, so they get deflected. And whereas normally, if they were in vacuum, they would form a jet cone of a certain size, because of their deflection, they go out of the jet cone. And so when you experimentally measure the energy within a certain cone, that energy is lost. But you could also lose energy directly into the medium through these binary collisions. That would be the elastic energy loss. Or if the energy loss of these gluons is very strong, they could basically be thermalized. So how much energy you lose out of the jet now depends on the amount of gluon radiation and the amount of energy loss incurred by these gluons as they go through the medium, and how quickly and in which energy range they can actually thermalize. Now, this is only about a year old. That's when the first events of this type, maybe a year and a half, were found. There are a number of different approaches to describe this that has been used. This is one that a postdoc that I've worked with did last year, where he basically wrote down kinetic equations for the distribution of these gluons inside the jet cone based on the effects of energy loss, longitudinal energy loss, and this coefficient that describes their deflection in terms of transverse momentum kicks. So you can write down a kind of Fokker-Planck equation for the distribution of gluons with frequency or energy omega, transverse momentum as a function of time, and then look at the transverse profile of this jet, and eventually, as it comes out of the matter, ask how much energy does an experiment that looks at a certain opening cone angle see. And it turns out that the distribution of these jet asymmetries, this quantity aj here is the ratio of the difference in the energies of the two jets divided by their sum. Whether this can be described by such a theory. The yellow histograms here are what you see in proton-proton collisions. Turns out also in proton-proton collisions, the jets are not always symmetric, because sometimes one jet splits into two, and so if you only see one jet, it misses half the energy. But this is usually a rapidly falling function of the asymmetry, as you can see here. Whereas in the nuclear collisions, the experimental points have a very different distribution. They look like this. So they are at much higher asymmetries, and they don't peak at zero. But you can get a reasonably good distribution of what the experiments see using a certain set of parameters of E hat and Q hat. So it looks now as if it is actually possible to determine that. If we use the ratio, if we use the relation between eta of s and t cubed over Q hat that I showed you before, and we use this value of Q hat determined from this comparison with the data, it corresponds to an eta of s of about 0.2. Now, it is not clear that this relationship was based on weak coupling theory in a gauge plasma should be valid at such small values of eta of s, but it at least gives you an idea that this is in the right ballpark. So it may actually be possible with more precise data and with a better understanding of how these jets propagate, which the data can then also check, to determine independently what some of these other transport coefficients are and how they are related to the shear viscosity. So this is an outlook of what may be possible. The theory, the theoretical description of this is really very new. Various people have tried to find relatively simple-minded way of describing it. The data are also fairly new, and they have not reached the full precision that they eventually can, because these jets are rare, and so you need a lot of statistics to have good measurements. And even in the conference 3 weeks ago, we saw the second generation of such experimental data, and they look much, much more precise than the data that are a year old, simply because there's a factor of 10 more in statistics. And experimentalists have learned how to look at different quantities also with higher statistics. But this is clearly something that will have a lot of data coming out. It would really be interesting to look at this not from the point of view of perturbative jet quenching in QCD, but also to look at it from the point of view of a strongly coupled plasma. If you have a parallel go through, how does its energy show up? How does it get depleted? But the problem here is that the scale at which the plasma becomes strongly coupled may be relevant. Right, because if it is a scale invariant system, then of course it's coupled on all scales. But in QCD, it's pretty clear that if you go to a scale of 50 GV, it is not strongly coupled. The coupling constant is small. So you would need to actually use a holographic dual theory that has a running coupling so that one can have in the same calculation regions in which the particle behaves in a weakly coupled fashion, radiating quanta, but in other regions of momentum space is strongly coupled and has the fluid properties that one now know from the other experiments to be true. So this requires, would require a certain amount of technical sophistication of the model that to be set up, but I think this would be an interesting approach that so far hasn't really been explored. So with this, I think it's time to stop and apologize for going over time a few minutes. That's the first time I actually had a hockey stick as a pointer. I like that.
Any questions?
You mentioned that actually, there were several directions which were converging, I guess, on 0.2, so 8 over S 0.2, A, like C, but you were saying that, well, maybe that number just isn't the same as that rift. Do you want to expand on that? Or?
If, when people have done the simulation, using the same initial condition at RIC and the LHC, they typically gotten slightly different values of 8 over S. But none of them have fitted correctly all the multiples. Now, this new initial condition may actually do the right thing, but it hasn't been applied to RIC yet. So my expectation would be that maybe the 8 over S is somewhat smaller. But, I mean, that's just a guess. One has to do the calculation, right? Because the in this calculation, the transverse scale of the fluctuations in the energy density is set by the saturation scale. That is different at the LHC by about a factor of, by about 50%. So the initial conditions have a different structure. And how that will reflect itself on the determination of the shear viscosity, I don't know. So it's something to be to wait for. But it is not obvious to me that it has to be the same value. I would expect a slightly slower value, a lower value. But whether it's 0.15 or 0.12, I wouldn't dare to guess.
When they go at LHC, they're going to have the shutdown, and then they'll have access to higher
right.
energy. Do you expect that it will change again, or do you think it's once they, well, if we use all of the data up to the end of this year,
right.
we converge on a
yeah.
number, will we
so
see the same?
The factor of 15 almost in energy between RIC and LHC made a factor of 3 in the energy density. So a factor of 2 more in the incoming energy will make maybe 25% change in the energy. It will produce a small effect. What it will do is, because it will increase the number of particles, it will allow for more precise measurements of higher multiples. So it could lead to a more precise determination, and also the multiplicity becomes important the more particle correlations you do, right? So it could actually improve 3-particle correlation statistics much more. So I think it will mainly have that effect, but not a tremendous effect on the conditions of the meta itself.
If I may abuse time a little bit, I kind of have a question related to this initial condition. So there are this new initial condition, and of course, the number of mods you can tune determines how much you can trust eta over s. So if I were to use these new initial conditions that were used in LHC, and then try to evolve this initial condition to back to the RIC scale, whatever I get, can I still represent with the same set of parameters? Should I reinvent yet a new initial condition? That is sort of evolution of the LHC initial conditions down to the RIC scale.
Okay, so what would change? The main thing that would change would be that the saturation scale at this was done for RIC. Q squared is 2 GD squared. Okay? The calculation that I showed you with the numerical implementation was for LHC, where Q squared is more like 3.5 GD squared. Okay, so the only quantity that you would change is the value of that scale. And you would use that then. Of course, that means that the coupling at that scale changes somewhat, but you would use renormalization group to fix that. So it would be a 1-parameter change, and that 1-parameter change would be tied to the difference in average energy density deposited. So that would be basically model independent, because it would again be determined by an experimentally measurable quantity. Right? And what this shows is that details really about the initial structure are really not important, I think. Right? So this could be the wrong approach, but within that approach, it is almost it is very tightly constrained.
Yeah, a question about the thermalization mechanism. Those one learn something new from the new HEC data, or?
Not really. Everything works the same way. In other words, using the same assumptions about short thermalization time works perfectly at the LHC. So that is not, there's nothing that leads one to believe that there is a change. But none of this determines the mechanism of thermalization, right? I think that's a very important thing. So one interesting question that hasn't been really addressed is, if I go back to this block, this is the energy density profile at 0.1 femtometer over C, right at the moment after the collision, when the gluons had no time to further reinteract. Now, how do you go from there to the thermalized distribution that you put in hydrodynamics? They use a kind of nonlinear glue field, non-abelian gauge field dynamics, that where they solve the Young-Mills equations classically, and they then smear it with a Gaussian distribution. But this is based on weak coupling concept. And then they say, well, and now suddenly we have strong coupling and have hydrodynamics. That's certainly not how the world works. It would be really interesting to understand how such a spiky initial energy density distribution thermalizes in a dual, strongly coupled gauge theory. I don't think anyone has done that, because typically all the calculations that have been done by Gupse and Chesler and Yaffe and so forth have all assumed smooth profiles. Nobody's done anything like this, right? Now, you would expect that as you get close to the horizon, all these short distance modes will rapidly damp and so forth. But you're not even close to a horizon at this point, right? You have a very ultraviolet, non-thermalized distribution. And what the typical timescales and dynamics is of how that thermalizes at strong coupling, nobody has explored as far as now. So that alone would be an interesting question.
So in view of time, so let's thank you again.